Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. During the spring semester, two courses work to connect students to the wider Albuquerque community through projects focused on building welcoming spaces and fostering conversations on challenging topics. Katya Crawford, an associate professor in the Landscape Architecture Department in the School of Architecture and Planning, taught the seminar Ephemeral Landscapes for Social and Environmental Change. Michael Pride, a professor in the School of Architecture and Planning, along with Catherine Page Harris, an assistant professor in the College of Fine Arts and the School of Architecture, taught Creative Placemaking for Activism. Both classes urged students to delve into issues about urban space and how it could be more welcoming or engaging to the community as a whole. Katya, I want to start with you. Your class this spring focused on the power of the ephemeral or temporary landscape installations. First of all, what do you mean by ephemeral structures?
Ephemeral is essentially, it is essentially temporary. I use the word ephemeral because it holds an element of magic that temporary does not. It can capture the imagination. So they're short-term installations, and I use ephemeral landscapes because they are not just standalone objects. They respond to their context, which composes or creates a landscape through that process.
What kind of projects have you guys been doing this semester?
The first was a project called CAGE, in which we worked with the provost's office. Well, it was a provost initiative called the Lobo Reading Experience, and we responded to the book Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, which is really a very powerful, fantastic book, and it really draws attention to the injustices in our justice system and issues around mass incarceration in the United States. So we designed an abstract prison cell, death row prison cell, to draw attention to essentially the confinement of a prison cell, because death row prisoners spend 23 hours a day in the cell, and as well as the issues that we face with mass incarceration in this country.
Now, did you put that up somewhere?
Yes, we put it up outside of the right in between the bookstore and the School of Architecture and Planning for a day. And then we moved it in front of the sub, the Student Union building, for a week. And now it's sort of hiding a little bit on the north side of the architecture building. One of the issues with ephemeral landscape installations is that, you know, they're temporary. So figuring out what happens to them after the fact is an issue. So I think we're going to try to get it to be a part of the Lobo Gardens. But it may move to Civic Plaza. We're not sure what its future life is. It may be torn apart and recycled as well.
So how do you gauge if you have impact?
I rely heavily on intuition, whether something worked or didn't work. And I trust it. It's totally an unacademic response. But my students learned so much from that. And we did a time-lapse video, and I think thousands of people saw it and lingered. And some people left flowers, other people. So I feel like it did have an impact. And we used design as a form of education and activism. And the students felt really empowered. We had a discussion afterwards about this particular project. And my primary objective is to the students, right? I'm teaching a class, and I want them to be excited, engaged, to become active agents within their community, whether it's in the school or outside. And I think that was very successful for that particular class.
Did you do other projects in the community?
Yes. So we did, and I say we for this one, but it was really a team of three students. So we worked with the Harwood Art Center, and it was essentially an 80-foot-long border, abstract border. So these are the issues, first of all, that our students are concerned with. Issues of the border, is issues of incarceration. And some others that didn't have installations around them were sexual violence, gender issues, race issues. So the border, 80-foot-long abstract border at the Harwood, filled with LED lights and stones marked with compasses. And at night, the piece glows. But it's really about people coming together at the border instead of being separated or interrogated. And it was, I think, a huge success. I mean, I saw people just gathering at the border on the night of the opening at this border that was glowing in the dark. It was really moving and quite stunning. Another project at the Harwood was 239 LED lights that were strung from an a Siberian elm tree, and they flickered and created this really ethereal, magical entrance, night entrance to the building, but it referred to the number of school shootings since Sandy Hook. And so it's a way to have conversations that are difficult and to give them a visible presence and have these conversations that desperately need to be had to make the invisible visible, to have a conversation over an installation, I think is easier in some ways than out of the blue. Maybe not easier, but there's a platform for it. There's a context for it that allows it to happen.
Are they still there at the Harwood?
Yes, the Border Project will be there, and it's called Wayfinding, until the first week in June. And the LED candles are still there, but they're on their way out. They had a lifespan, so they'll be taken down very soon. So those are some of the examples, but we've got others. I think we did 6 installations this semester with the students.
Michael, your class is called Creative Placemaking for Activism. What is creative placemaking?
Well, it's a great segue because I think a lot of the projects that were being produced in Katya's class really are examples of creative placemaking. So creative placemaking is a movement that's grown over the last 10 years almost, that talks about engaging the kind of creative industries and creative people in making places and transforming places, whether it's for the mere act of changing the nature of them, like flipping the narrative about a place by making it appealing, or about ways to bring people together to talk about difficult, important issues in their communities. And so they're about that place and getting people of that place organized in a conversation.
And Catherine, from your course description, there is good creative placemaking and not so good creative placemaking.
Well, I think, you know, there's a, as Michael was saying, there's a 10-year plus history, relatively speaking, of kind of the term of creative placemaking. And some of that has been sort of healthily debated for a while because of the nature of gentrification and the reliance on artists as kind of a first wave of changing the kind of inner cities and the shifts that can happen in a place once what I think in the 21st century is now termed creatives show up as sort of altering kind of a city fabric. So our class actually created a whole series of proposals for the Central Corridor and then chose one through a process of inviting community input and then also kind of analyzing feasibility. You know, what could we really build given the money that we had available and the time and the talents, really, of the students, you know, that we had available. And of course, you know, this course, as structured as it was around the Central Corridor, you know, clearly involved issues that had to do with the new public transportation that was being implemented and talking about and with communities, you know, reactions to that. But I think creative placemaking in general really involves also providing an outlet for artists that gives them a sense of value within a community. So allows artists to move from a kind of solo production process where it's their concerns and their issues through a kind of actually difficult process of engaging with other people's issues and ideas and concerns. And, you know, when we had a community group say, well, needle exchange, you know, needle pickup is really our problem, all of a sudden the students were thinking, wow, you know,
how do I artistically respond to that?
How do I respond to this, you know?
Yeah.
And also recognizing that that response is not solely yours, but needs to include, you know, sort of others' issues. And I think that's a real challenge. It's a challenge for me as an artist and a designer, and it's also a challenge for the students themselves to figure out how to move from a kind of dialogue with themselves to a dialogue with a larger public.
Michael, what was the project you guys came up with?
The end result we titled The Sharing Shelves. And it's part Little Free Library, part Little Free Pantry. It's a solar-powered charging station for USB devices. Can even offer lighting, and with an inverter can accommodate, you know, a traditional AC-powered device like a laptop or a PA system like we had on Friday.
Don't forget zine station.
And a zine-making station, because there's a desk and a place for seating. And I think we're going to work on building the seating over the summer. But the zine-making is a wonderful process that we learned from friends that are in a group called Together for Brothers, which is a community organization focused on empowering young men of color, all the way from, I think, junior high school age through young adulthood. It's a very interesting group. And they use zines to essentially ask people who they are and what they want. And our students were inspired by that.
So the idea, you set this up somewhere in a community place. What's going to happen with them?
Well, we set them up at the caravan site, so last Friday.
This is the place on Central that was the Country Western Club. They're going to make a new library there on Central.
Yeah, and the original, actually the student impetus for creating these bookshelf idea really came from one of our planning students, and she proposed a kind of form that would be really literally a letter, and books would be shelved in this. And through the process of the class, that became the desire for it to become more flexible, so to be able to reflect many languages, potentially other words, you know, that we didn't just say read, but we might say leer, and we might say doc, and we might say something else altogether.
Because it's a very diverse community.
Because it's a very diverse community. Yeah, so, and we ended up setting up the four of them. So we had a pop-up event where the library came. Hakeem Bellamy, who was the poet laureate of Albuquerque and is now working in cultural affairs in the city, came. International District Healthy Communities Coalition came and brought together all these different initiatives. Fascinatingly enough, just the people who came took a lot of books. I mean, we had this amazing donation from UNM Press where they gave us books, 300 books to distribute, and we had books that were individual donations as well. You know, so people came and took books and took food and got gift cards for participating in making zines. And it was really a short event. So it was 2 hours. We popped them up. We took them down. One of them is now at the...
It's in front of Luther House.
Yeah. Where's that?
It's right here on campus on Las Lomas. But in this interesting kind of overlap of this small world of Albuquerque, there's a group of UNM students who are also part of Together for Brothers who are creating this amazing business model, basically selling coffee, but it's a highly democratized co-op business model. And they're creating kind of a pop-up coffee shop in front of Luther House. And so now one of the sharing shelves is up there. So we'll see how it runs there. And we're looking to create some other partnerships where we can deploy the other units to places along the Central Corridor and use it as ways to think about how those areas might develop in the future, as well as just engaging people in those questions that don't normally show up. And that certainly was a case on Friday night.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm talking with Katya Crawford, Catherine Page Harris, and Michael Pride about the courses they taught this semester, one about creative placemaking for activism, and one on ephemeral landscapes for social and environmental change. How did your projects help bring community members' voices back into the process of creating urban spaces?
For us, and for the ephemeral landscapes class, when we speak about community, we tend to think of community as out there, right? That it's something even separate from ourselves. And that's something that bothers me, that we are also part of community, and there are different sort of levels. And it also has this sort of warm, fuzzy feeling when sometimes it can be really tense or very different opinions. And so for the Caged Project, for example, that was very much about a UNM community. It was right on Central Avenue, and it responded to this book, Just Mercy. Others that are outside, like, for example, in the past, not associated with this class, but through the UNM chapter for ASLA, the American Society of Landscape Architects, we do a parking day, pop-up park in downtown Albuquerque. And people come by and talk to us and talk about their vision for the city. We've also worked with ACE Leadership High School. That's high school students and local businesses along Central. And we've had some pushback, too. You know, some businesses really don't want us taking up a parking space because someone might want to park there and buy a hat from their store, right?
So, you just do it for a day, right?
Yeah.
You take a park. This isn't a worldwide thing. You take a parking space and make a park. And,
yeah, take a parking space for a day and turn it into a pop-up park. And it has become an international event, and it was started in 2005 by Rebar, a small firm in San Francisco. But it's a way of visioning what is possible. It's essentially a seed, and it's a generative act. You know, activating the imagination about what's possible with some dedication, a little bit of money, passion, it doesn't have to be a giant thing. I mean, I'm hoping that these pop-up things have these spill-out effects of making more dramatic change. But there's tremendous value, I think, in the one day and in the interactions and the connections that you make with people and the conversations.
I'm curious, Michael and Catherine, because you're doing this in the corridor where, we're still waiting for this transit system to be up and running. But as we all know, highly controversial. Many people felt their voices were not heard. This pop-up project seems like it's inviting the community back into the corridor to talk about what they need or what they want to see.
Oh, it's so true. And I've been involved in a project for the last year and a half, almost 2 years, called the Central Corridor Neighborhood Study, which is specifically about that, how neighborhoods might change in the wake of the investment in the ART. And so the more conventional processes invite a bunch of people who have lots of resources, maybe not explicitly, but that's the outcome, to think about this future where they make a lot of money or have a cool place to live. And we really want to bring other people to the table, the people who are already there, and think about what it takes to serve their needs. So these kinds of projects, we think, I mean, it's kind of interesting that the buses aren't running. You know, it's an advantage in some ways, a disadvantage in other ways. But maybe we can have that conversation that was kind of not present 2 years ago. We can have that conversation now, even though the infrastructure is there. Now that it's there, let's talk about how it can work for people instead of trying to think of ways to take it down and, I don't know, do what with that infrastructure. So,
for me, it was a really interesting process of kind of opening up the potential for a positive in that project, because I think there was so much resistance that developed over the course of a kind of general apprehension about not being heard, especially within the community of the class, and then within the community members that we sort of spoke with. There was at least the possibility of opening up a conversation about what was valuable, you know, the sidewalk widening or the trees that had been planted or the, you know, sense of sort of placemaking that even just the stations provide in some places. And then what was potential that was as yet undeveloped, like the site that we were working at could have an ART stop but does not, you know. And what are the conditions under which that could be developed and made possible? It was an opportunity, I felt, for us all to treat it as a potential good that had yet to be really realized, as opposed to sort of focusing on the negative aspects of what was going on. And I think part of that is just the struggle to build, I think, inherently, for me at least, creates a kind of positive joy. In order to put something out into the world, you have to really believe in its positive existence. Like, literally, you wouldn't, in fact, make it if you didn't believe in its existence. And so the process of making for the students, for the instructors, for the community itself, sort of put out this kind of joyful energy into the world that viewed the possibility that there could be a functioning bus stop and crosswalk and library and story plaza and sharing of shelves, of books, of food, of, you know, people's stories. There was a transgender woman who walked up and gave a speech because we had an open mic that was being powered by the solar shelves. And that wouldn't have been possible, you know, 2 hours before we put it up or 2 hours right. after we took it down. And I thought that that was a really beautiful instance of how making something and engaging in a positive way can really shift, even in that sort of briefest of moments, the possibilities of a place.
Yeah, it was, I think, interesting. Even while we were setting up, the site was being policed by the transit management truck pulled onto the site, and all the people that were gathered under a tree and at the bus station, at the bus stop, were gone in 5 minutes. And so you think of the shift between, hey, come in, get some books, make a zine, put in a ticket for a drawing, and maybe get a gift card for Tullin Market, instead of, hey, you need to get out of here. It's such a shift. And so I think what Catherine described was such a shift in the energy of the place that made people feel welcome, no matter who they were or their background or their situation, as compared to another, maybe at another moment where they're pretty wary.
What do you think the students in your classes took away from your work this semester doing this?
We still want to know.
I got a really great email saying, watching you persevere through all these problems really inspired me.
That's great.
From one of my students, which I just loved. He really made me aware that the potential that I was, you know, problem solving on the fly was actually inspiring.
Yeah, I got a really amazing email. I asked students what they expected at the beginning of the class, and one student said, it was very funny, said, I expect my soul to be saved.
No pressure.
That is the end, you know, this like intensity of architecture school. And so I got an email that said, soul saved, thank you.
Oh.
You know, and so that was this like beautiful moment. But I feel like there's this sense of, with the current political administration, this sense of kind of hopelessness. And the students really felt empowered to have a design voice, that making and collaborating is a generative act. And that's something that Catherine has alluded to or stated clearly as well, that making is a generative act and you put it out there. You know, we read our cities and we understand when we're not welcome somewhere. We can feel the hair on the back of our necks go up if we feel unsafe. And there are also visual signs that we learn about, like there are literal signs, no loitering, no trespassing, don't step on the grass, all of these sorts of signs, no skateboarding, no bike riding, no this, no that. Even I went down to Civic Plaza to look at the new fountains. And there's a whole lot of rules for that, too. Don't get in if you've been sick in the last 2 weeks and, you know, all of these sort of things. So we are used to, like, performing in a particular way in a city. And it's that moment when you say, wait a minute, I live here, too, and this is also my city. It's not just determined by laws and by other people. There's a sense of ownership, of claiming that. And I think when that moment happens is when really interesting things start to happen. It feels like a democracy. It feels like democratic space, which is what we all want.
Feels like civic engagement.
Right. Well, Katya Crawford, Michael Pride, Catherine Page Harris, thank you so much for coming and talking about this, the courses that you taught and what you did with your students.
Thank you. No,
thank you
so much for having us.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. You just heard from assistant professors Katya Crawford and Catherine Page Harris, as well as Professor Michael Pride. We had planned to also have a student of Katya's in our conversation, but he was unavailable. You can find photos of the work their students did this semester in the community at kunm.org. Now we go to our segment that focuses on interesting research by the faculty and students of the University of New Mexico that you may have never heard about.
Nobody's ever gonna read this!
This is Marty Adamsmith, afternoon freeform host, in the studio with UNM recent graduate in history, Frank Blasquez. You have a project, a still photography project called New Mexicans Told in Pictures. What is that project and how does it connect to your studies in history?
That project is basically a photo documentary project. It's mostly individual portraits. Most of my subjects are dealing with themes such as drug abuse, domestic abuse, recidivism, dealing with workplace racism and economic despair. So that's mostly the tropes that are within my portraits. In history, we deal a lot with primary documents, mostly textual primary documents, of course, as you're within like the institution. That's mostly what we're going to be dealing with. But I like to say that I deal with visual primary documents, so just showing the, people the proof right away. Sometimes people have told me that my work kind of flirts with muckraking. So if that's kind of how people would like to explain it, then maybe I can use that route as well. So, but yeah.
In addition to these stories like depicting difficult life circumstances, who are your subjects demographically?
My subjects reflect mostly the Chicano, Latino, Hispanic, Spanish community, Spanish speaking. Some don't speak Spanish. Some identify as Mexican American. Some only identify as Hispanic. Some identify as Indo-Hispanic. So yeah, I like to keep that spectrum really broad. But if I were to kind of give it like an all-encompassing name, I would basically say like the Latino sphere and in New Mexico, focusing mostly on the war zone in the South Valley areas of Albuquerque, New Mexico. So,
and in addition to the still photography project, what are you working on with film?
With film right now, one of my subjects, he has a really compelling story. His name's Felipe V. Hill. We got in touch with him after he just got released a couple months ago from prison. And he has a really good story. He's really trying to turn his life around after years of substance abuse. That's called Duke City Diaries, and he's one of our primary subjects on there. We're dealing with a few to several subjects that we're going to try to consolidate into about a 90 to 120-minute feature. So me and my cohort, John Acosta, will be working on that this summer, 2018. So hopefully it'll be out soon so the New Mexico audience can enjoy it and let us know what they think.
Is there any one anecdote from your subjects that you'd like to share with the KUNM listenership?
Yeah, I mean, I can basically go off of Deco's story. I'm sorry, Deco is Felipe V. Hill. That's his nickname. He has a wonderful story. He learned how to tattoo in prison, and he told us some of the things that he learned in there is that you have to keep your mouth shut and you have to stay true to your art to be what he considers a New Mexican artist is someone that stays true to their culture and stays true to within the state of New Mexico, trying to keep everything consolidated into one unity of the Zia symbol of making sure people feel welcome within this state and promoting art, because it's a major art state compared to everything else. You don't move to New Mexico to start a business. You move to New Mexico to become an artist. So
very cool. Thanks so much for coming in, Frank.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me here, Marty. Thank you.
That was Marty Adam-Smith with recent UNM grad Frank Blazquez. You can find a link to Blazquez's work at KUNM.org. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.